Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. These ideas find their antithesis in superstition, religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, medievalism, totalitarianism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce this week's guest, Andrew Muller.
Thanks, Padraig. Andrew Muller was born in Wagga Wagga, Australia in 1968 and has lived in London and hotels since 1990. He currently writes on numerous subjects for various newspapers and journals, The Independent, The Independent on Sunday, The Guardian, Monocle, Uncut and New Humanist, among many others. Andrew was previously the author of Rock and Hard Places and a contributing editor of Robert Young Pelton's The World's Most Dangerous Places. His latest book is I Wouldn't Start From Here, The 21st Century and Where It All Went Wrong. And that book is described on the back by Little Atoms regular Jonathan Meads thus, Muller is a gung-ho candide with a taste for places that is wiser to avoid. His book is graphic, comic, bemused and properly contemptuous of faith and ideology. And I think as most Little Atoms listeners would agree, that's high praise indeed. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the book. It's a collection of travel pieces, basically, from the 21st century, from various trouble spots. But there's a sort of theme that links everything, so let's talk about that. Well, what's it actually about?
You'd think I'd have a short answer to that by now. It is, as you say, to an extent, a collection of dispatches from assorted places, a lot of which were just accumulated as I went about my business of being a freelance journalist. Some of which were undertaken specifically for the book, but the more I travelled in the period chronicled, which is the 21st century to date, the more it occurred to me that diverse a lot of these stories were, there were some underlying themes. And the idea for the book basically came from that idea that if you're the age I am, which is 40 years old, you'd grown up with the idea that the 21st century was going to be the future. It was always assumed that this would be this sort of golden age of enlightenment and inquiry and progress.
The Cold War is finished. The thing that's overshadowed.
Has overshadowed the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there was always this great symbolic importance attached to the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And I think there was always this idea that this is the century in which we as a species will get it right. And obviously it hasn't... It's not worked out like that. And it did occur to me that part of the reason for that was that there's just so many things that so many insanities and inanities that we live with and take for granted and never question. And a lot of the book is about that, just saying, well, if people are going to choose to believe and do things which are palpably and demonstrably absurd, at what point are we going to be, the rest of us, going to cease to be obliged to take any of them seriously? That is, the throwaway line on the back is that the grand question the book seeks to answer is, what is it with these people? And that's a slightly cheap shot, but that's more or less it.
So what sort of things are you talking about then? Let's talk about some of those insanities and inanities that people are still doing.
It's all the greatest hits, really, many of which were alluded to in the introduction to your program there. It's things like it's religious faith, subscription to conspiracy theories, blind nationalism, the clinging to of ancient historical grievances as justification for, you know, retributive violence delivered in the present day. Just all the things which beset are almost part of the geopolitical world's weather. But when you actually step back and look at them with any sort of rational perspective, you actually just, you know, they make no sense. And it's occasionally reasonable to ask, why are we doing this? How long do we, you know, until we actually figure out that this is getting us nowhere?
There's a sense where, you know, we're all very kind of, you know, fond of, well, that's not all of us, but we're very fond of our cultures and the aspect of culture. But what you mentioned there was historical grievances. And do you find, like, having travelled quite a bit, that people hold on to historic grievances, not just as a completely rational thing, but as an intrinsic part of their identity?
Yes. Absolutely excellent question. And yes, that happens. And it's an incredibly self-destructive aspect of any culture, when that idea of victimhood becomes central to the culture. Nothing good, I don't believe, has ever come of encouraging people in the belief that they are victims, because it's either telling people or they're telling themselves that we are helpless, that there's nothing we can do, that everything that is wrong is somebody else's fault, and it's an absolutely unhelpful way of regarding the world as an individual or as a society, to think of yourself as a victim. I mean, it goes nowhere good. There are some places in the book and in my observations which at various points have been more prone to that than others, sometimes with a lot of outside encouragement, others not. And it's hard to say what specifically does tend one group of people to thinking that way, and other groups of people who have been, which are also mentioned in the book, are admirably able to dust themselves off, you know, rebuild, rethink, and move on.
I think perhaps maybe the Balkans conflict, particularly, where everyone had a grievance and everyone wanted to be the victim. There was a one-upmanship in victimhood, almost.
There was a dynamic in the Balkans in particular where everything that was terrible that was done by your people or your side was justifiable because something else had been done by somebody else last year or the year before. You know, going all the way back to the Battle of Kosovo Field in 1389 or even before that. And it may just be because I grew up in a reasonably young country, in its present form, certainly Australia, that it took me a long time to understand that, you know, these people are actually serious, that there are people genuinely upset that people with vaguely similar surnames to them lost a battle in the late 14th century, which just strikes me as all the things you could choose to care about in this world as truly extraordinary. But that dynamic you mentioned of always finding someone else to blame, the best expression which I ever heard for that, which is mentioned in the book, was coined in Northern Ireland, which is another place prone to it, which was the phrase whataboutery, which means that whenever you sort of try to hold somebody accountable for what their organisation has done, they say in response, well, what about, and then name the last terrible thing that their opposition did. It's a lovely expression, but it's no basis for discourse.
Podrick's already raised the Balkans, and I was going to raise that myself, because I've written down, paraphrasing a section of the book here, and it's entirely my fault for writing it down like this, but I've written down some of the things that are common in the developed world, such as freedom of speech, free press, democracy, free trade, and secularism, and some of the likely things to happen in the undeveloped world, such as dictatorship, censorship, corruption, ethnic tensions. But of course, these things are just bubbling under the surface everywhere, because you know, the Balkans, it's an ancient ethnic tension that was at the heart of Europe, basically.
Well, there's ethnic tensions everywhere, or they can be created, I think, anywhere in certain circumstances. And I got very vexed even at the time when Yugoslavia disintegrated, people choosing to write it off as if it was some sort of natural phenomenon, that these things are just going to happen because these people are just superstitious peasants who every few centuries will just hack each other to ribbons for reasons, you know, no sane person could comprehend. I think that's simply not true. Wars are not natural disasters. Conflicts are not natural disasters. They don't just happen. Somebody chooses to start them. Somebody makes a decision to start them. And in the case of Yugoslavia, that choice was demonstrably made by particularly Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia and Franjo Tuđman in Croatia, who decided that they would start this war. And they knew that the reason, way they could start that war was to flam up ethnic hatreds, which there are certain conditions which you need to be able to do that. You need a substantially uneducated population, or at least enough of them that you can get their dander up. You need a certain monopoly over the distribution of information, which the Yugoslav authorities in those pre-internet days had. And then all you basically need to do is tell poor, frustrated people that your poverty and your frustrations are entirely the fault of these people over the next hill, and stand back.
I have a kind of, it's not an entirely original theory, but it's probably reasonable to say that a lot of the broader tensions that we've seen, that there was a real microcosm of that in the Balkans. There was Orthodoxy versus Catholicism. There was the rise of militant Islam and jihadism beyond that context. But maybe it's an element that I overplay, or maybe it's an element that everyone else underplays, but the Balkans, as the kind of great religious conflict of the late 20th, early 21st century. Well, not, it didn't spill into the 21st. Was, I mean, did you sense that the religious aspect was very strong there?
No, I genuinely don't think it was. I think it was a much better summation of that fallacy was made by P.J. O'Rourke, who at the time defined the religious differences between the three warring factions by saying that the difference, the religious differences essentially boiled down to the fact that the Serbs didn't go to church, the Bosnians didn't attend mosque, and the Croats didn't go to mass on Sundays. It was a substantially secular and largely irreligious society. The religion became a means of splitting people rather than a cause for the war in the first place. My own view of that particular conflict, and it's not unusual, it's often overlooked, is that it was substantially a conflict between, as we would say in Australia, between the city and the bush, and between modernity and secularism and plurality and backwardness, basically. It was rarely reported and often forgotten to try not to confuse Western viewers that thousands and thousands of ethnic Serbs fought for Bosnia. The Serbs who lived in Sarajevo fought for the Bosnian army against the Bosnian Serb army because they thought their loyalty was to their city and not to some sort of absolutely arcane and irrelevant idea of ethnic brotherhood. It's a really common thing, I think, that it's also really telling, taking a much broader historical perspective, that dictators and tyrants are rarely from big cities. They're almost always outsiders. The dictatorship is their revenge against the middle classes and against all the things that cities encourage. It's their revenge against modernity. You know, Stalin was a Georgian, Hitler was an Austrian, Milosevic was from a small town outside Belgrade. Radovan Karadzic was a sort of bellicose parvenu who was upset with the cafe, the cafe society of Sarajevo because they didn't take his terrible poems seriously.
Much as Hitler was upset with the cafe society of Vienna,
for not buying his paintings. Yeah. I think that was a point of the Balkan conflict that a lot of people missed. It was, you see, I think, echoes of that in the sort of modern, Islamist jihadi movement as well. It's a revenge on progress.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on to that, I just want to stay in the crucible of the Balkans for the minute. And as we've already sort of discussed, the book is a series of travelogues of places where things have sort of gone to pot. But it's not all doom and gloom. There is a lot of sort of hope there. And you talk about a lot of activist groups and groups of young people, particularly in various places in Eastern Europe, in the Balkans of Croatia and then in Albania. And I want to talk about these for a little bit because they're great. They're young and idealistic people who want to make a difference. Often doing putting themselves in quite dangerous positions.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit more about some of these groups.
I mean, the groups you're referring to are the people who ran what have become known as the colour revolutions, the sort of populist revolts against and determinedly peaceful revolts against tyrannies or dysfunctional democracies in various parts of Eastern Europe, most famously against the Milosevic regime in Serbia, but also in Ukraine and in Georgia. And they were largely youth-led, youth-organized groupings. They did have certain amounts of funding, logistical assistance, and encouragement from various Western governments, specifically Britain and the United States. But I have absolutely zero difficulty with that at all. I think there's a fairly clear moral difference between that and arming the Contras. It's interesting the phrase you used, idealistic. They're actually the reason I think they were so successful. And it was amazing they had a big conference, all of the groups, in Tirana, Albania, one weekend, which I attended. And it was amazing to think you're just in a bar with like 40 or 50 people, none of them over the age of 35, and think the people in this room between them have brought down four governments. But what actually struck me about attending their deliberations that weekend is that they're not idealistic, and that's why their movements worked. They're practical. All the discussions they had, it was really interesting. There were no discussions of ideology or dogma. These people had not had the luxury, as we have had, of living their entire lives in the security and peace, prosperity, and general pleasantry of a modern secular democracy. They were the last generation who'd grown up in Eastern Europe when it was still a prison camp. Mm-hmm. So for these people, things like, democracy, transparency, rule of law, property rights, these aren't even arguments. This is all just self-evidently good stuff, and all their discussions and all their it was all about how, not why. And it was kind of invigorating for that reason. There was no sort of dissent, as I think often happens with self-styled revolutionary groups in the West. There was no sort of dissent into Judean People's Front variety arguing over ideological arcana. It was just, how do we get this done? And that's why I think they were so successful.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny, and we are talking to journalist Andrew Muller. We've just been talking about popular movements, popular democratic movements, peaceful popular democratic movements bringing about change throughout Europe from, I suppose, really, so we're talking late 80s onwards, really, and throughout Eastern Europe. And now, another part of your book, you go somewhere where there was a very different attempt to bring about democratic change, which was, of course, Iraq. What was your experience there?
I've had a few experiences of Iraq, the first of which was instructive, which was a visit there in late 2000 when the previous administration was very much in charge. Mm-hmm. And that made a huge and lasting impression. I wasn't there long. I was there, I guess, for a week or so, a week and a bit longer maybe in Baghdad, but it's a weird area to get into because it's very easy to trip over and it's starting to sound like a neoconservative crackpot, which I'm relatively confident I'm not. But I do absolutely believe, and it strikes me as pretty uncontroversial, but nonetheless, it's just a basic idea for the organisation of a society. People should not be frightened of their government. Mm. It's no way for people to live. It's a terrible and debilitating and psychologically excruciating way for people to have to live. I mean, the comparison I have made in the book and elsewhere is the entire society ends up as dysfunctional and depressed and as a woman who persists in an abusive relationship. It's mm-hmm. you can't imagine any other reality. The self-destruction becomes self-reinforcing. It's a terrible way for people to live. And in Iraq in particular, under Saddam Hussein, on a few occasions I was with mixed groups of foreigners and Iraqis, and if a foreigner in this grouping would mention either Saddam Hussein or one of his two delightful sons, the Iraqis would just get up and walk out of the room. They did not even want to be thought of having been in a room in which the ruling family were even being mentioned by foreigners. After you got to know some people a bit, and it was a huge leap of faith for them to make, they would talk a little bit and very, very guardedly about life under Saddam Hussein. But it was dreadfully tense and a huge risk for them to take, and nobody should have to live like that. So that said, I was against the invasion of Iraq, but only because it struck me as a fairly klutzy way to get one guy out of his job, which surely I thought was what we were trying to accomplish, and which I think was a perfectly worthwhile and noble ambition, by the way. But it just struck me, though I'm no expert, that there must be other ways of doing that. It's not like Iraq wanted for smart people who were capable of running the place in his absence. And then I was back in Iraq shortly after the invasion. I remember we drove in from Amman on the same day that George W. Bush sort of did his action man impression on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln and said mission accomplished, which was an image that gave us much opportunity for laughter over the couple of weeks that followed. That was an extraordinary period. Baghdad was an absolute madhouse at that point. It wasn't as violent or impossible as it became. I mean, it was possible to travel around as a foreigner. I mean, it was still a risk, but it was a risk to do anything. It was in a state of complete and utter, well, anarchy is the only word. But people were not kidnapping or murdering foreigners, you know, routinely. Mm-hmm. There was a sort of a sense at this point that, like, wow, this is crazy, and hey, you're here, and okay. No one really knew what was going to happen, where the battle lines were, or who was going to be fighting who about what. And then I was last in Iraq early 2005 in Basra with a company of Welsh guardsmen who were doing, I thought, making a reasonably heroic stab at doing what was a clearly completely impossible job. People are going to be talking about, you know, the invasion of Iraq is going to be the stuff of doctorates, books, theses, and degree studies for decades and decades and decades. It's possibly our origins of World War One. It's going to be one of those stories. I think it says quite a lot that 6 years later, I still don't think anybody's too clear on what it was actually about. There's no, it's unusual that you have a war that most wars you can point to and say, here's why it happened. And that's one of those ones that I think the fact that there's still 1,000 different opinions as to what the war was about, I think, tells you quite
but
a
again,
lot.
But again, that makes the World War One analogy very
well. Exactly,
actually. No one's quite sure
what
happened.
There's a point in the book where you make the statement that at the beginning of the war, it was easier to find opponents of the war in the capital cities of the people that were fighting the war, as opposed to in Baghdad. And then obviously you've been back a number of times since. So when did you notice that change? I mean, when did you think the tide turned?
What I remember thinking that, and the bit you allude to, is I'd gone to Iraq because I'd written quite a lot suggesting the invasion was a bad idea. And then when it happened anyway, I thought, well, if it's possible, I should go and take a look. So I did. And what I mostly did was tried to find as many people as possible who I'd met 3 years previously in Baghdad and basically said to them, you know, how's this working out for you? So I spoke to them and to a lot of their friends and their families. And I remember driving out thinking, this may not be such a bad idea. This could work. There was an enormous amount of genuine unforced gratitude for the removal of Saddam Hussein, especially among middle-class Baghdadis. There was a startling amount of faith, I thought, in what the Americans could do, even though I think what Iraqis were hoping the Americans would do was, you know, fix what they broke and go home again. But there was genuine optimism. There really, really was, and I was surprised by how much of that there was, and I was surprised by how really little rancor there was towards the militaries who had just, you know, invaded their country. I mean, a point was made by one of the journalists I was with. If you imagine that, you know, a coalition of Middle Eastern countries had just conquered Great Britain. And imagine how long you'd last in London as an Iraqi journalist, just sort of like going for a bit of a walk among London's conquered people. I mean, I think that'd be a pretty short walk. But as it was at the time, everyone was, you know, really perfectly nice to us, which I think tells you quite a lot about how people felt about it. Where it went wrong, again, millions, thousands at least, of better qualified people than I am have pontificated on this. All I can say from my own experience is that, given the complete chaos of Baghdad at that point, I remember another journalist saying in a hotel bar one night, in a very joking way, as if this could possibly be the case, and said, it's almost like they never actually sat down and had the meeting about what to do when they got here. And as subsequent research, specifically I'm thinking of Thomas Ricks's book, Fiasco, and Ranjit Chandrasekharan's Imperial Life in the Emerald City, those meetings genuinely never were had. They had literally conquered a country without having stopped to think about what they were going to do with it once they'd got it, which is belief beggaring, but so much of human history is.
So we talked about the idea that there were more people against the war in London, and there is a fantastic chapter in this book that I want to talk about because it basically parallels the idea behind why this radio show was set up. And you write this in the aftermath of the 7/7 bombing. So, I'll let you tell the story of that.
The section on the July 7th bombings in the book was there because it's a repudiation of the idea of the chorus which attends every Islamist terrorist attack in particular, that the phrase root causes is what always comes up. Again, it doesn't strike me as controversial to say that when you consider any action for good or ill by any human being, that I'm pretty sure that the overwhelming majority of responsibility for it lies with the person who actually did it. But even after something as obviously, you would think, as insane and indiscriminate as those bombings, large numbers of people who were, you know, at least are allowed to write columns for newspapers, sort of sailed into print to suggest that it was actually all somehow our doing. I mean, I isolated a few of the more completely preposterous examples, and in a couple of ways it feels a bit of a cheap shot to sort of point out, you know, Tariq Ali for writing something ridiculous, because that's what he does. But the absolute apotheosis was John Pilger's bizarre response to it in The New Statesman, in which he blamed Tony Blair entirely for the bombings, and not once in the 1,641 words he wrote, and I counted them, did he actually mention the names of the bombers. Again, call me simplistic, but I thought they deserved a certain amount of the blame for having, you know, decided to build explosive devices, carry them onto rush hour public transport and detonate them. I'm inclined to point the finger at them a little bit. It strikes me as pretty basic stuff.
There's you describe that in an interesting way, because while people might see that it's understandable that somebody could be angry about something, as you describe, they clearly talked about it, sat down, decided on a plan, slept on it, went and did it.
Before anything like that, there's always a meeting. It's not a spontaneous reaction. It's not. And the example I use is I've seen it happen. A Palestinian who is being stuffed around at an Israeli checkpoint on a hot day and he's got a heavy shopping bag, loses his rag, you know, slaps a Israeli soldier on the helmet. It's not a smart thing to do and it's not a nice thing to do, but, you know, you can see it. People lose their temper in the heat of the moment. Terrorism is never carried out in the heat of the moment. There was a meeting. There was always a meeting.
I think that's probably a good place to leave the show. Thank you for joining us, Andrew. And
thank you for having me.
Next week.